Each assault boat before me had had 2 minutes to disgorge its Marines, who were then in turn given assigned objectives. When we got to the place where we were to land, it was called Red Beach, and it wasn't a beach at all. It was a vertical pile of stone. The earlier boats had gouged a dip in the seawall so that we were able to jump out of the boat into the water and climb up into the dip in the seawall and there take refuge, because by the time that we landed, the enemy had zeroed in. Zeroing in means that if they didn't have good aim before, they did now. they had us in their range. More and more boats discharged Marines, and most of them crouched in this dip because the enemy was shooting at us. And by about 6 o'clock at high tide, the last of the waves had landed, and a terrific rush of water came up the dip and we turned, and the landing ship tank was bearing down upon us, its plank door halfway down, and it couldn't see us because the landing ship tank is very, very big compared to these small assault boats, and couldn't see all of us there taking refuge in the dip, and was about to squash us all. The water had given us warning, however, and we extricated a few who were left behind. We had the bullets incoming or no, get out of the dip, and we took off across the open beach and took refuge behind a mound. That was for us. But this was 6 o'clock when six landing ship tanks, it was only 8 hours plus 30 minutes, six landing ship tanks were then docked, had their planks down, and despite incoming fire, they were starting to roll out the equipment. They were stranded there on the assumption that we would secure that beach. When I say stranded, I mean this. By 9 o'clock, as we knew, all the water would be out, and those LSTs that had come in on the tide would be left on mudflats. And they were. That's getting ahead of the story. We were behind this mound, and we could see people zigzagging across the beach, quite a number being casualties, because the tracer bullets, which were very beautiful there in the dust, would pick them off as they ran across the beach. And I was, as I said, behind the mound, and I want to give you a description of myself to explain the rest of the story. I didn't look very feminine. I had on a helmet and slacks and an overcoat, which was all wet, and I guess I was pretty unrecognizable as a woman. In any event, as I was sitting there, taking refuge behind this about 15-foot-high piece of earth, a lieutenant from the Marines came over and started yelling to Arla's group. There are three correspondents. All right, you big, brave Marines, let's get going on this unloading. And he reached down and grabbed me by the collar and yanked me up. And by the time I pulled myself together or away, so that it was a little while before I could talk. And, at that point, I said in my most formal manner, though I admit I pitched my voice higher than usual, I'd be very glad to help, sir. He was a little surprised. And he allowed his, well, he said, first of all, he said, again, I can't quote him, what are you doing here? And I said I was a reporter. And he said, oh, well, then, in that case, he figured that I had my regular duties and that I better go about them. And however, the interesting technological point was that he said, you'll have to go away from that mound. And we said, why? He said, because we're going to take it away. And sure enough, we had agreed to meet a third correspondent back at the mound. He'd gone up to the LSC to look after communications. We were supposed to stand right by that mound and wait for him. Well, a bulldozer came over, and just like the Marine colonel said, it wasn't there anymore in about 5 or 10 minutes. And tanks, trucks, big heavy tanks were rolling through in the darkness up to their appointed places, your jeeps, your 2.5-ton trucks. That jeep that beach, which had been a bare, deserted place, which we'd been afraid to run across because of incoming fire. This is now about 6:30, an hour after H hour, was humming with amount of traffic that made me feel that the incoming fire was preferable to the tanks and the trucks and the jeep that you had to dodge at 6:30. And I thought that, well, I'd leave it by 7 or 7:30. We must have had a dozen tanks and perhaps 30 jeeps and, well, a great deal of ammunition off the LSTs, and I thought it was indeed a tribute to our technological coordination. Needless to say, the beach was quickly secured after that, and all, even though the LSTs were stranded there on the mud flat, there was no need to worry because we had enough equipment to handle any enemy action from that time on. I still am amazed when I look back on the speed with which we got our equipment on that beach. The, as you know, those early days of victory, I call them early days, September seems a long time away, were very, very quickly ended. In the fighting for Seoul, our air power did a tremendous job in clearing the ridges, the high hills that surround Seoul, of enemy, and I saw from many forward command posts the Marine Tactical Aviation go to work on the enemy with a great deal of precision. Having been one of the first to be resentful of being strafed by my own airplane, I feel that I ought to praise the way the ground-air coordination improved in the latter days of the war. I want to give you two quotes that stuck in my mind. First time was the same day when we ran into the sergeant. It was a good day for quotes that day when the jets, who make a terrific noise when they come in to strafe and napalm, started coming after us again. They made a mistake. We had very bad electronic communication and they were strafing us, and we took shelter, tried to figure out which way they were coming, and took shelter on the side of the mountain road. And I was next to, I think it was only a private first class this time, and he said with feeling as he looked up at the jets and shaking his head, he said, "Gee, why don't those guys either stay at 30,000 feet or go back to the officers' club?" Well, that was, and you didn't feel very friendly towards your own aircraft, even if they were your own aircraft when they were in the process of strafing you. But there, I think it was only a week later, I was in a forward observation post when, as though we were watching the Mustangs and jets dive bombing some tanks in a row before us. In Korea, you probably have seen in the moving pictures, it's very much of a newsreel type of war because of the great height you could get on hills and see this very dramatic military action that was taking place below you, because you were quite safe on these huge high hills and you had a panoramic view very often of the events that took place in the roads ahead of you. And watching the planes really doing a beautiful job in against the tanks that were coming against us, another soldier said very admiringly about the Air Force plane, "Gee, those guys ought to have bayonets on their propellers." So they caught on very quick. I wanted to tell you a little bit about General Douglas MacArthur, since he's been a fairly controversial figure. I want to tell you one thing in particular, and it hasn't got very much to do with the Korean War, but it has a great deal to do with MacArthur's ultimate place in history. I've heard and read that some people regard him as a reactionary. I think the British press calls him semi-fascist and all the rest of it. I think it's a great misrepresentation, and I think the record is there. One thing that very few people know is that MacArthur has put through one of the most revolutionary land reforms in that part of the world. It's a kind of land reform that, if it had been put through in, let us say, China, that the Chinese people might have had enough of a stake in their form of government so that they would never have welcomed, as many did, the Chinese Reds. Land reform in Japan is really a revolutionary thing in Asia. It gives a great number of people a stake in their new way of life. And by dividing up the land and giving so many, erasing land tenure and tenancy, MacArthur has won a great many people to this position of having a vested interest in the new democracy that is in Japan. That doesn't guarantee that democracy in Japan will work. Nothing guarantees that, because that depends on a great number of variables. But it does give them, as I said, a great stake in their new form of government. MacArthur as a person, I've talked with him a number of times, is free of the poser and rather autocratic attitude and dramatic attitude that he frequently does take in public. There's no denying that the man has a theatrical sense. The first time I went in to see him, I was greeted with great courtliness and was sort of bowed to and called Miss Higgins and talked to with all the grace and courtliness of the old school. Then the Korean War came along and I became a combat correspondent. And MacArthur was, as you know, responsible for sending me back, and all this publicity came out about Higgins, the tough frontline combat correspondent. So after my tour in Korea, I went back to see the general. And this time when I walked into the office, as I say, he has a theatrical sense, I was greeted, "Hello, Higgins." Which surprised me so much, I said, "Hi, General." I don't want to make any final judgments about man as a military leader, except I'd like to suggest this one thought. People who are military experts, and I climb right up from under that category right now, people who claim to be military experts did hail the General, General MacArthur, as a genius at the time of the Incheon landing. Then I noticed that, which was a gamble, and a gamble which was against the judgment of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who tried to talk him out of it. He was supported by the President of the United States, and he went through, and it was a very big success. He made another gamble in the North, and he gambled not only on a military way, but he gambled partly on the basis of a political judgment. By that I mean he assumed or hoped that the Chinese intervention at best was going to be a half-hearted one and not an all-out one. That was a political judgment. He had no way of assessing it militarily in light of the fact that he had no chance by the rules of reconnaissance and all the normal channels in military intelligence. His second gamble, there's no doubt of that, did not succeed. But I don't think that a man who was, or at least it seems difficult to assess the man who in September was a military genius as being in November the engineer of a military disaster. The next phase of the war in Korea, which sticks in my mind, is again with the Marines, and this is no reflection on the Army, it just happens to have been one of the dramatic retreats, and I happened to be in the northeast part of the country. That was from the Chosin or Changjin Reservoir. I caught up with the Marines when they'd come out of Udamni and were on the tip of the reservoir at a place called Hagaru Ri. The thing that I thought was the most admirable about that was that the Chinese seemed so indomitable at that time. They were pushing the rest of the army very fast and very far. And the Marines, when I walked into Ray Murray's tent, Ray Murray was the colonel who was the regimental commander of the 5th Marines. He was, first of all, very surprised to see me at Havaru because there had been no outsiders or strangers.